you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Nick Mason back on the show. Of course, Nick is the co-host of Myth of the 20th Century, a weekly podcast. He also, I guess, contributes to the American Sun website, correct?
Yes, I do some work for the American Sun website as well, yeah. I got some stuff coming down the pipe.
Okay, and well, tonight I wanted to have you on to talk about, you did a show a while back for Myth of the 20th Century, studying the murder of Mary Fagan and the Leo Frank trial. Of course, what happened there was in 1913, April 1913, Mary Fagan, who had worked at this outfit called the National Pencil Company, went to pick up her pay, and she never came home. She was murdered. Leo Frank was eventually charged and convicted for her rape and murder. And he was subsequently lynched after the governor of Georgia had commuted his sentence. But there's much more to that story. It's been treated very differently in the press. I was just this afternoon going through how it's treated in the Washington Post. You do a Google search. The vast majority of the reports treat it as if you have this is a example of anti-Semitism in the South. He was lynched. He was the general consensus is that he was indeed innocent, or it's very controversial. But you've studied this case, and I've read about it a lot in the past few years. I'll let you talk about it. What happened with poor Mary Fagan and the Leo Frank trial and its aftermath? What does it mean today?
Well, you mentioned, Tim, the modern historiography of it and what you'd read in, you know, mainstream papers such as the Washington Post. And what's so interesting about it is that it's contrary to the traditional liberal narrative about the South in general. I mean, you're expected to believe that the post-Reconstruction South was willing to believe the testimony of a colored man against that of a white man. And I say white specifically because one of the most enduring myths, and just one of the most bizarre myths, is this concept that the South was anti-Semitic when it's actually quite the opposite. The South was and is to this day philo-Semitic. Leo Frank, first of all, was a business owner and prominent in the high society of Atlanta. And he was not the only one. Much of industry in Atlanta was Jewish. This, to my mind, has always been the strangest part. And one of my favorite books, I think the best book on the Leo Frank case, came from the Nation of Islam, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's a part of a, I believe, 3-volume series that they did on African-Jewish relations in America, Jewish involvement in the transatlantic African slave trade being, I believe, the second volume. It is, I think, the final volume. It's the 3rd volume. It's Leo Frank, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, something to this effect. And it really helps from this perspective to look at it because, I mean, Leo Frank was the only Jew ever to be lynched in the South, whereas there were innumerable Africans who were lynched. And so from their perspective, the whole story is just bizarre, and it really shows the racial power dynamics at work.
Yeah, in the trial itself, Leo Frank's attorneys attempted to more or less frame a black man, Tom Conley, for the crime.
The best attorney's money could buy, mind mm-hmm. you.
And at the same time, if you read about what was said in the trial, they things that weren't very flattering towards, you know, Mr. Conley and also black people in general, in order to turn the jury against them.
It was a very hostile, racially charged and hostile trial for most of the trial. Interestingly enough, though, they did, once the Northern press, Northern Jewish press, mind you, particularly the New York Times, was really the main player, which was, of course, owned by Ox at the time, who was, of course, a Jew, Adolf Ox. And you had others get involved, too, from the North, other Northern Jews get involved, such as, Jacob Schiff, the great Bolshevik financier, as well as the American Jewish Committee's president, Louis Marshall, and big shot Jew advertising executive of Chicago, Albert Lasker.
That's how they got Hearst papers online with threatening to boycott, right, with the advertising.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah.
I think, if anything, what really upset the people, what led to the enormous local public outcry against this farce was the perceived aggression from the North. I mean, it was less they try to frame it as a hostility to Jews, but if anything, what the South was hostile to was just the North and Northern money power. Where, yes, this was Jewish money power, but that wasn't really what factored in as much. I mean, this was something that one of the great, you could say heroes, and certainly one of the great writers and speakers around the case like to highlight, Tom Watson. And I would definitely encourage people who are interested enough to go back and read Tom Watson on the case. I mean, he was really Johnny on the spot there.
His paper was a Jeffersonian? Did I get that right?
Is that right? I'm pretty sure he worked for the one of the main Atlanta papers for a while, too. I do not remember. I should not say, because I do not remember exactly.
But he was a journalist who, I guess, got involved, after the trial, correct? Because of the Jewish activism.
Yes. Exactly.
From the North, primarily. And, of course, it's important to mention that I think that Leo Frank himself was head of the local chapter of B'nai B'rith.
Yes, that's very important because, mm-hmm. as we'll, I'm sure, go on to talk about, one thing that emerged from this was the ADL, which effectively a private intelligence organization that is devoted to maintaining Jewish power in America.
Yes.
And this is the founding myth of it. However, that being said, the ADL, they deny that this was the case that, you know, led to their inception. I'm not really, to my mind, this is just more lies, but because if anything, what it was, one dynamic we can get into is some of the big Jewish power elite we had mentioned, many of them not only viewed Frank as likely guilty, but did not like Frank. And it's, I think it's instructive to note that after Frank was lynched, they mobilized, I think some of the estimates, if you convert to, you know, present day money, they spent somewhere around $30 million on this. And that's money that was spent doing things like committing felonies. I mean, witness intimidation, witness bribery. They hired multiple top-end private detective firms to, you know, see what they could dig up, likely on testifying witnesses as well.
Yeah, that was right. They suborned perjury and purchased, you know, they bribed people. Yeah, the detective that went down there.
Yeah, there were a few people who changed their tune throughout the trial, a few people who redacted testimony, et cetera, and a likely explanation for this is the big money that was floating around. I mean, this is a lot of money in the rural, well, it's Atlanta, but still there were many poor whites. I mean, Mary Fagan herself was working for pennies in effectively a sweatshop.
Yeah, that's the context, is the, of course, this is 1913. The South is emerging from the devastation, you know, of the so-called American Civil War, and but they, at the time, the people of Atlanta saw themselves as sort of emerging industrial power and these things. But nevertheless, there was, you know, what happened after the Civil War was the exploitation of the South for whether it's cheap resources or cheap labor, made available by the war itself. That's an old you know, model of exploitation. And so you had a lot of people working in factories. And, of course, child labor is anything new. But nevertheless, you had a lot of, you know, people of Mary's age working in the factory. And I think it was – and people were bothered by this. One was Tom Watson. I think in his own postmortem of the case, Tom Watson claimed that the Frank case was punishment for the sinful economic exploitations of children. He writes, I got this from E. Michael Jones' article on that. The National Pencil Factory, owned by Frank's people, fought a child labor bill fiercely and helped to kill it. And in God's mysterious way, it cost the superintendent his life. In the closing ranks behind Frank, the nation's wealthy Jews had blown the breath of life into the monster of race hatred. And this Frankenstein, whom you created at such enormous expense, will hunt you down.
So that's. And I should add a sexual exploitation as well.
Yes.
Because some of the circumstantial evidence to Frank's character and behavior was that he, you know, basically forced girls into sexual relations with him, using his leverage as their boss, and that other co-workers of Mary had testified that he had made advances on her prior to her murder. And furthermore, the star colored witness, Jim Connolly, he testified that one of his capacities was to stand lookout for Frank while he had sex with these girls.
And I think didn't Frank try to get him to write notes or something, or did he end up writing it himself?
It's not clear. The note was a major piece of evidence in the case that was used to implicate Connolly. It's not clear if – I mean, Connolly obviously was not very bright, and he was also a drunk and a criminal, a petty criminal, mm-hmm. not a rapist murderer. But it's not entirely clear whether Connolly was duped into writing the note. Like, I mean, he had, I believe, a first grade education. Okay. So the two possibilities there are basically, yes, Frank either wrote it himself to make it seem like Connolly wrote it, or Frank just duped Connolly into writing it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, here we have in the South where you have a black man at the scene and a white man at the scene. And we're to believe that the racists of the South were willing to let the black man go, who, according to Frank's legal team, was the guilty man, just to go after a white man who's Jewish.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And we are to believe that the police colluded with a colored man to help cover up the crimes of a. Or sorry, the police colluded to cover up the crimes of a colored man. Right.
Yes.
I mean, this is extremely far-fetched. Mm-hmm. Another thing that was a big shock to people was Leo Frank's refusal to confront, as was his legal right, to confront Cottonley in court.
Yeah. So, and I guess even the police noticed his demeanor was suspicious when they interviewed him.
It defies all credulity that in the, you know, post-Reconstruction South, a white man, and again, I have to keep emphasizing this because you have to understand that the South was and is a philo-Semitic place. And so he was a white man for all intents and purposes. And if you read, I mean, you read the documentation around it, the newspapers, et cetera. I mean, he's referred to as a white man. And so for a white man to refuse to confront a colored man over accusations of murder and lying against his honor, et cetera, I mean, it's just absolutely absurd in this context, which was very damning. To most people, this was a very damning thing. I wanted to go back real quickly, though, to what I had said earlier. The people like Ox and Lasker as well were they believed he was probably guilty, and they thought he was a pervert. Ox said as much in his private writings. And so you have to wonder what exactly is going on here. Why? I mean, first of all, it's a peculiarity of the Jews that they're one of the few people who would do something like this, if not the only people who would be willing to defend a man who, I mean, is powerful. I think it's a cynical ploy, and we can speculate. I have my theories as to what the reason for this is and what was going on. But even still, there were five Jews on the jury, all of which believed him to be guilty and passed the sentence as much.
That's right. Unanimously, which you have to get. And he had a trial. Evidence was presented. He was given a rigorous, a very expensive defense. Nevertheless, he was tried and convicted. And every appeal was turned down, right?
It was the longest and most expensive trial in Georgia state history up to that point. And I believe, actually, that might still be true. I'm not positive about that. But it was, to that point, definitely the biggest trial.
And for people like men like Watson and others in the other Southerners, this was a test of whether or not equality before the law would be vindicated, that those who are guilty of murdering young girls would be held accountable to the law. And just because you were wealthy, you couldn't get off. And this was the principle was at stake. And it seemed that this was going to be overturned because, he goes to jail for his crime. And I believe the judge sentenced to death on his birthday, to die on his birthday.
yes, he did, exactly.
Yeah. But the governor steps in down there.
Yes, Slanton, I believe his name was. Yeah, and he commutes the sentence. And he commutes the sentence, I believe, 2 or 3 days prior to the end of his tenure as governor.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, of course, an obvious conflict of interest, being that his law practice was being merged with the Jewish law firm that was responsible for the Franks defense.
a bit of a conflict of interest there. And of course, when he does this, there is a brewing riot, and I think he's hung in effigy. And
yes,
I think
they hang the governor in effigy. Yes.
So the state militia or National Guard has to be brought out to disperse the crowd. He hightails out of the state, I think, then is feeded up in the Waldorf Astoria up in New York.
Yes.
He goes on tour, right? The country and ends up in Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly.
So the sentence is commuted, but justice will not be denied. What occurs?
Well, they local people break him out of I believe, Marietta County Jail. And they hang him. They hang the Jew criminal.
And didn't they take it to, I guess, just outside Mary Fagan's house or something, or hometown?
Yeah, and I believe the location where he was hung is like a strip mall today.
So. It's fitting.
Very fitting.
I guess the thinking being that if the wheels of justice are going to be, not allowed to work and be corrupted, that justice, you know, the people take it in their own hands. And this is an example of a lynching where a guilty man is indeed lynched.
Yeah, and I would add, though, that contra liberal historians and the popular narrative, much of the lynchings in the South were lynchings of guilty men.
Oh, well, obviously there were. I mean, there were innocent men done. I mean, lynched too.
Oh yeah, no, there's no question about that as well.
But everyone quite often,
like, if you say you talk about lynching, it's assumed that it's just because to be clear, there was no real recourse. If a Negro was accused of a crime, he had no real serious recourse to justice if he was in fact innocent. However, what you had was a situation where a underclass of slaves who are have certain proclivities towards violence that are less common amongst the white population. You know, they committed crimes, and this is how it was dealt with.
Well, that fear would, as harsh as it sounds, is the fear of consequences for one's actions are going to, it's going to regulate one's behavior. And this is one way. I mean, we had, out west, you had sort of the vigilante justice in these things. And that isn't given so much of a racial tinge to it, but it's the same principle at work. It's just in the historiography is particularly... in the 20th century, it's portrayed as something. It's always an innocent man. It's always an Emmett Till or something who's getting lynched, and something like that, a case like that.
As opposed, Emmett Till is subject of another story. But while Emmett Till was not guilty of rape, Emmett Till was not as innocent as
If you read his background, his family background, it's very troubling. So it's not the story you always get. But So he's hung, but then this is when it really gets interesting, because in many ways Leo Frank is worth more to the Jewish community dead than he is alive.
Absolutely, this is one of the key points.
Yeah,
he absolutely is, because he was an embarrassment. I mean, he was a murderer and a rapist and a pervert at that. He was not well liked, and in fact, his own wife refused to be buried next to him.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty revealing, but yes, you're right. He, as a dead man, he could be turned into this martyr figure, this innocent man.
Should we say a Christ-like figure?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, it's funny because the 2003 Steve Olney book is titled "And the Dead Shall Rise," which you're the more of the Bible scholar than me, but I believe that is a Bible quote.
So this becomes it's an example of sort of a cause celeb, and also an example of this is the early 20th century, and obviously Jewish power isn't quite like it is today, but nevertheless it is obviously very influential. It's just more a sub rosa, more subtle at this point, a little, I guess you could say. But
So what I would point out, the Leo Frank case, one of the big takeaways is it was the first real mobilization of all of the Jewish money power. You had the big trifecta. You had the media, the money power in the form of media, in the form of Adolf Ox, the money power in the form of Jacob Schiff, and the advertising in the form of Lasker. So you had all these big figures come together to distort public perception and to buy justice. To buy what they want.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned to you off call where I was watching in the late 90s a show called The Murder of Mary Fagan, I think the movie's called, and starring Jack Lemmon, Peter Gallagher, a very young, what's his name, guy from House of Cards. Kevin Spacey's in it, yeah. And I watched it and I thought, okay, it's one of these stories, and I figured generally true. It's a movie, but it's probably the basic story is true. But it is a complete inversion where Leo Frank is portrayed as being completely innocent, and it's an example of backward, redneck anti-Semitic Southerners lynching a Jewish guy.
And yes.
So, and that's in the 90s, and that's following the historiography that apparently that was created by the by ADL, B'nai B'rith, and organized Jewish power throughout the 20th century.
Yeah, I think what we see is just these people realize that this is effective, and that we need to codify this. And I think that because this was the moment that they were all mobilized to act in concert, that he just it became symbolic to them as the Jews have had this problem though too, when anti-Semitism is not just something that they need to justify to the Gentile population. It's something that they need for their own people, in order to keep them in line. And this becomes especially true after, 1948, in the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. But it was, it was something that they needed to tell Jews that there's anti-Semitism in America, that there was a threat to them. And this is how they become fantastic. In addition to being supported by already wealthy Jews, they get a lot of money for this stuff. And when every time you have, some, be it real or concocted, typically concocted, I mean, 9 times out of 10 concocted, anti-Semitic incident, they say, the checks come in.
Yeah, the Southern Poverty Law Center is a great example of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, where they exaggerate the influence and power of the Ku Klux Klan, because you have ignorant Northerners who have no understanding of the South think this is a serious problem. So they write the checks and these things. And recently you had this Jussie Smollett case, who I didn't know even existed until he apparently staged this event. But with him, you have a 3-for-1, because he's Jewish, black, and homosexual.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I believe friends with Kamala Harris as well.
Who just, by the way, was submitting a federal anti-lynching bill.
Yeah, I saw that. Absolutely hilarious.
Which is,
yeah.
I like the little timing on that, because that's, to me, that's sort of like evidence of some sort of weird form of collusion or something. As if, yeah. I don't know, I think I was listening to Ramsey Paul had a short little YouTube posting today talking about blood libel. And he says, talking about the blood libel, he talked about what the blood libel is historically with the Jews and, using Christian blood to make bread and these things. He says, whether it was true or not, is whether some people did it, whether the Jews were all guilty of this, it was wrong to say that all Jews were guilty of this. At the same time, it's also blood libel for Kamala Harris to submit a bill, anti-lynching bill in the Senate, suggesting this is an ongoing problem. And he said, he did a little research. He found the last actual lynching of a black man by a white man was 1981 in Alabama. And the person who perpetrated it was put to death by the state of Alabama. So why do you need another law?
what's funny is, Tim, you mentioned the KKK. And yeah. This is another, this is really the Jewish chutzpah, as they would say, on full display. Because here you have them slandering and exploiting the racial tensions in the South, mm-hmm. to attempt to exonerate a guilty Jew. And if they succeeded in doing that, they would have also incarcerated an innocent Negro. Mm-hmm. Okay. And one of the claims that they like to – this is why – obviously you're not going to find someone in system media and in academia who's going to challenge this. But what's so hilarious about it is when they reiterate this Leo Frank myth, they're also implicitly condoning the anti-black tactics that were being used, right? Mm-hmm. And they claim, for example, that the Leo Frank lynching was what instigated the revival of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, not true. And also, I should add that there were many Jewish members of the 20th century Ku Klux Klan. And what really revived the Klan was the D.W. Griffith film, Birth of a Nation. And who financed Birth of a Nation? Not only who financed Birth of a Nation, but Birth of a Nation was a wildly successful film at the time, made an absolute killing, and that money was used to create Samuel Goldwyn Mayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the absolute nerve.
Well, it's like who owns the label, record labels, the rap companies, and make rap music. You know?
Right, which is why these people hate Nation of Islam so much.
Yeah.
Because they refuse to be patsies to Jewish power, at the same time call out the historic exploitation of Africans by Jews.
At the same time carrying out an agenda of cultural degradation too. Using
right.
blacks as proxies for this. Promoting
yeah, and yeah, that's yeah, another yeah, thing Nation yeah. of Islam tries to resist. They are, as far as black organizations, they are the most successful in terms of creating a model for Africans to not fall into these traps, albeit they're just a small fish in a large pond.
Well, what's interesting is that goes back to this era, because this is the time, you know, when the NAACP was being created, sort of the integrationist agenda, and it was that was always Jewish run, and that was set up to oppose the agenda of like Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey, who wanted to promote black identity. And the integrationist model has always been a Jewish strategy to use it sort of as a more or less as proxies, shock troops, or you know, to I guess undermine a host society. A good example would be. That some people interpret the Leo Frank case and the Jewish reaction to it as the reason for Jewish support for the civil rights movement in the succeeding decades was revenge for Leo Frank, is going, you know, carrying out sort of a more or less a regime change operation in the South under the guise of integration and civil rights.
Yeah, the revenge for Leo Frank, like the problem with Leo, the reason for revenge against the South, I should add, is not because the South lynched an innocent Jew. It's because Gentiles had the nerve to bring justice against a Jew.
Yeah, that's really that. That's that tribe mentality, I guess.
Right, and yeah. His innocence has his alleged and innocence has nothing to do with it. But it's funny that you mentioned Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey, because another irony of this is that, you know, that Jim Conley was actually the most published in papers like the New York Times Negro ever until, you know, later 20th century, much more so than those men. His words, that is, obviously.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah,
not his writing, because he couldn't write, but you know, and it's I believe it Ron Unz makes the point that had Leo Frank actually been a white man, had he actually been a Gentile, it would have been a seminal moment in African history in America.
When a black witness.
Yeah, right. A black witness being believed. The New York Times, pardon me, printing his words at the extent to which they did. You know, that the testimony of a black man be believed over a white man. But this is distorted because Leo Frank was a Jew.
Yeah. And I guess we're treated to the narratives we're real familiar with is, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, right? Harper Lee's, and of course, the great movie. It is a great movie. But that's not the only narrative that ever, you know, occurred in these situations. And, you know, again, the idea that what mattered wasn't so much that he was guilty. There may be a certain yuck factor among people like you know Adolf Ox or Lasker, and you know, who are coming to his aid, and they're admitting that he is a degenerate, but he is a member of he is Jewish, and as they, and not only is he Jewish, he is a member of B'nai B'rith, a Jewish Masonic secret society, and whatever secret oaths they have, they will protect one another, and so the life of a little girl, Christian girl, simply does not matter, juxtaposed to Leo Frank's, you know, membership in B'nai B'rith, and also the fact that he is Jewish. And this,
absolutely.
There's you can see some elements of Talmudism in that outlook.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And this, again, we're not under the because of the so much Jewish influence in media and publishing, they've been able to control public discourse in these things, control the grammar in these things, and so it's difficult for most people not just to understand it, but then to articulate it in public without suffering some form of ostracism or career setback.
Well, it's one of those things too that it's the old like, how do you know so much about this? Like merely like being informed and having studied this at all is ipso facto proof of anti-Semitism.
What are you obsessed on it? What are you?
The irony is there's some truth to that because you're probably not going to look very far into this unless you already have some criticism of Jewish power.
Yeah.
So there is an ironic element of truth to that claim, but that's usually what they hide behind. It's like, you're not allowed to know too much about something like this, or else this is confirmation that you're some kind of thought criminal.
Yeah, they'll pathologize it, or they'll psychoanalyze it using their weapons.
Yeah, precisely.
And then again, what is a good example? Yeah, you won't get. I was listening to Andrew Joyce talk, and he was just talking about any history of the Jews or Jewish power organizations. He was shocked, or not shocked, but he took notice of the fact that anyone who writes books about this are Jewish, or they're published by Jewish-owned publishing houses. So there's very little tolerance or opportunity for a sort of a critical analysis. A critique, if you will, of Jewish power and Jewish organizations, because obviously, if you criticize anything, if you criticize, I guess you're paranoid if you believe that the World Jewish Congress or AIPAC or the Mossad or the Israeli State or Hollywood, has somehow organized to protect a certain group of interest against the other groups or the host society. But then if you just apply common sense to it, of course, they're going to group together and they're going to organize and they do it very well.
Yeah. You're paranoid, but when you point this out, they all come after you.
Yeah. They destroy you. It's like, wait, if they don't exist, why am I fired? I think it's obvious. You just can't talk about it in polite society.
Yeah. Oh, these people all know. I mean, look, if you look at any system media outlet like Fox News or something, these people all know what not to say.
Mm-hmm.
There's no great mystery here. They know who not to criticize. They know to give favorable coverage to Israel. I mean, these people are mercenaries. They don't really believe in anything to begin with. They just want to get paid. So it's not like they're not aware of who's paying them.
But it's again, what it is the portrayal in history is with various movies we see, it's the anti-Semitism is always irrational. It's not based on any experience in dealing with Jewish organizations, Jewish people, and so this history becomes incomprehensible. It's just crazy irrational hatred. There's never anything that Jewish organizations or Jews do that bring about people's resentment. Which,
Tim, again, we don't even have a word to describe Jewish malice or racism against Europeans.
That's right. Yeah. And they have the term anti-Semitism is so vague. It doesn't mean anything. It's basically criticism of anything associated with Jewish power or going against Jewish interests. And there are Jewish interests, right? I mean, I don't think I'm going too far on a limb to say that there are, tangible Jewish interests that,
No, they have names. They have organizations that have names. They have zip codes. They have addresses.
Yes.
I mean, it's comical, but it's just the whole concept that the ADL is based their founding myth is that of a Jewish pedophile rapist murderer. I mean it's astounding when you think about it, what these people are able to get away with. But
and even today,
I think it was Revelo P. Oliver who described the ADL as the group of Jewish cowboys that ride herd on the American cattle.
And well, this matters because this gets to the issue of sort of the idea of the guilt machine they operate, right? They guilt everyone because of certain narratives that they've able to sort of become the normal understanding of history.
They cry out in pain as they strike you.
Yeah, and you know, this is same thing they've done with culture, where they've sort of had this immense influence of culture. Now it's the default culture of the country itself, and they've done it with. People have written books about whether it's abortion or pornography, and you know, there's overwhelming Jewish influence in those things, and Jewish and activism that brought about legalized abortion in the country. Bernard Nathanson writes about that, and he even himself referred himself as a revolutionary in these things. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency, they look at a host society, a certain amount of antagonism and also fear, and it's all part of that rabbinical strategy of convincing Jews themselves that they're just a day away from a pogrom.
So absolutely.
So they always have to be on guard, have to coalesce, and this is how you create group cohesion through fear.
I think it's safe to say. I mean, I'm sure there's curriculums, and I did in the program I did on it, I did go over one of the ADL scripted teacher handbooks to be given to school children, mm-hmm. to be given to teachers to teach school children. They do this, but that being said, I think just by a basic survey of people you know, I think it's fair to say that most people don't actually know who Leo Frank is. Whereas I don't think I'd be going out on a limb to say that probably every American Jew has heard of Leo Frank.
Yeah.
I think that's the what it's more aimed. Initially, it was more aimed at them. I mean, the so-called Holocaust trumped it, obviously, as far as the guilt machine goes. Mm-hmm. Well, one criminal Jew being lynched in the South versus the ovening of 6 million.
Yeah, the lampshading, soaping, and
the soaping and lampshading of 6 million.
Yeah, putting in cages with gorillas and tigers or something. I don't know.
Attached to. Elaborate masturbation machines and made to play electrified pianos. Yeah. I mean, we could do a whole show on that too. I mean, much of the Holocaust, so-called firsthand literature is effectively like pornography. It's like the 70s Nazi exploitation films.
Yeah. It's almost like Schindler's List was that way too.
Schindler's List is just a glossed up version of like Elsa She-Wolf of the SS.
there was in black and white. Elsa, I think, was in color, right? No, but any.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a serious art.
It's film. Black and white, and I just remember, it was that, and I guess it was 10 years ago. It was shown on ABC Network uncut. Without commercial interruption, and a lot of nudity in that film. A lot of it, not just the shower scenes. It ended up being a real shower, by the way, even in Schindler's List. But the sex scenes. And I remember at the time it was being shown on ABC, Howard Stern was complaining because it violated FCC. They got a waiver for the FCC regulations.
Howard Stern is complaining about pornography?
You know what he said? All you have to do to show nudity on network television is kill a few Jews. right, because remember, if you go back into the 60s, The Pawnbroker, a Rod Steiger film, was right. A Holocaust survivor film. And this is the first movie to show bare breasts front, and it broke the production code. But no one could criticize it because it was a Holocaust film. So again, they cynically use the Holocaust to break the production code and unleash Hollywood in its effort in the sexual revolution, these things.
Yeah, I had not actually seen the 88 Leo Frank film that you mentioned. It was 88, right?
As yeah.
I said. Yeah, I had not seen that. I did struggle to watch the relatively recent documentary, The People versus Leo Frank, which used the Steve Olney material. It's very bad, not worth your time.
Mm-hmm.
But I am a bit surprised. Maybe I'm not that the Leo Frank case, because there's just no good. I mean, especially in modern post 1964 racial revolution America, there's no way you can really gloss up the. I am a little bit interested to see that the dramatization you mentioned, because it's just a story that with the current race politics in America, it just wouldn't make sense to the narratives that they're putting out now.
If I recall from the 88 movie, and I saw this years ago, and you can watch it on YouTube for free, I think. It's still up there because I saw it. The way they portrayed it in the movie is that Conley, the white jury, which I don't think they mentioned that there were five Jewish members of the jury, but the white jury was so racist that they were convinced that no simple black man, and yes, all black men are simple, basically because white people are racist in Atlanta, could tell such a convincing lie.
Correct. That comes directly from the 1966 Dinnerstein book. I have not seen the movie, but the Dinnerstein,
is
exactly what Dinnerstein tried to do, because that's one of the only things that they can really do. And that is what. Yeah,
so even when white people are willing, even white people don't want to lynch a black man for a crime he didn't commit, and don't want to assault an innocent black man, they're still guilty of racism. Right?
I mean, that's... Yeah, heads the Jews win, tails the Jews win.
Yeah. It's like, okay. So, oh, okay. And so that's why they were convinced that Frank had to be guilty, is that no one, that basically he was set up by a black man who was playing stupid.
Well, and the thing is there is some truth. Like, I'll tell you how that really played out. It's that people were skeptical. I mean, it's the exact inverse is what's true. People... He was subjected to like 16 hours of interrogation,
mm-hmm,
in court, and he stuck to his story. And that's why they believed him, because they were convinced that it boggles the mind, because that's the whole point. Is the reason they believed him is because he was able to stick to his story for 16 hours straight and be consistent with the facts, whereas Frank, quite to the contrary, was not. And so that's why they believed him, because they didn't think highly of a colored man's ability to fabricate a story. So the fact that he was able to be consistent was what gave credibility to him.
Mm-hmm. Simple honesty, more or less. Yeah.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah. So with the, I mean, it's just, so the Frank trial itself, and its outcome, and of course the lynching, and then the media campaign afterwards, is sort of, yeah, like you said, it's the first example of this ability for organized Jewry in the United States to manipulate it, to flex its economic, cultural, political muscle, and completely invert in a narrative to set the public mood, so they can again exploit. They can play themselves as the eternal victim, and then more or less exploit the resulting guilt. Whether to get some sort of law passed or concession. Obviously, other future narratives of oppression or wrongdoing would enable organized Jewry to extort. Mass reparations, multi-generational reparations, and also the creation of the state itself of Israel, which was a Zionist project, which brings in the question, the Jewish influence in the world wars. And that's something that doesn't get much treatment, how the fruition of the Zionist dream was made possible by the world wars.
Oh, absolutely.
And the narratives that flow from those wars.
Yeah, and the distortion of history for 100 years. I mean, they'll never walk this back. They have no reason to. Who's going to make them? I mean, if someone is in a position to force these people to own up to their lies, then they have much bigger problems at that point than the story of Leo Frank.
Well, it's making them walk it back or hold accountable, even just answer questions. In many countries, you'll be imprisoned for it. For doing that, and if someone's narrative requires the threat of imprisonment to have it to be upheld, then it's time you start to question that narrative.
Yeah, I have no doubt that they would like that to be true here. They would like to see the books done by the Nation of Islam on Black Jewish relations to be thrown into the memory hole.
Well, recently we've had the U.S. Senate passed the ban on BDS 77-22.
Yeah, right.
BDS. This is something that's just flagrantly unconstitutional, yet it passes overwhelmingly. You know, now what that is just shows that Pappy Cannon was right when he said so many years ago that Congress is occupied territory.
Right. And it reminds me of the Joe, since you mentioned Pat, you can't help but Joe Sobrin comes to mind and his old quip that an anti-Semite is somebody who is disliked by Jews.
Yes. It used to be that someone who disliked Jews. Now it's someone who now is Jews dislike. But this is a reason why Benjamin Netanyahu gets 29 standing ovations when he addresses Congress.
You know? Right.
I heard reports that he had like APEC representatives like standing guard, making sure everyone stood up.
Yeah, and you don't want to be the guy who stops clapping first, just like. Stalin.
It's gotten that bad. I mean, it's the fact that something like that, a bill like that could be. Proposed and then passed overwhelmingly, it says a lot about the current situation. But nevertheless, there seems like at the same time that I guess there's a reason for this is at the same time you have growing consciousness of this, the political response is becoming more, I guess, radical or more extreme because I guess they're panicking. Because when would they ever have to pass a law like this? If you think about it, it's a sign of weakness. Ultimately, I think.
Yeah, you got to wonder though, because in America itself, there's no organized, there is no real serious beat. It's much more a problem in Europe.
Yes.
So in America, I think they're just flexing. It's not like the BDS had to be passed in order to prevent a serious boycott movement. In Europe, though, yes, like it's true, especially in England with Corbyn, it's a real thing. Because in general, in Europe, European politics, Palestine issue has actual representation where it does not in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Here in the States, you still have figures like Soros and. Of course, you have the Jewish influence in the migration crisis and immigration. Of course, their historical support for mass immigration, non-European immigration, and that was a Jacob Javits, I think, Hart-Celler Act, I think. But even to this very day, they're the biggest advocates of sort of this weaponized migration or the into the United States and also into Europe. Barbara Leonard Specter's remarks are.
Right. And yeah. I mean, and it's Leo Frank is a microcosm of how these people operate mm-hmm. because, just like with the migration thing, I mean, it's Zionist interests that lead to these Middle Eastern wars that devastate these people's countries. So they don't actually care about these people, just the same way that they were happy to try to throw an innocent African under the bus in the old South.
Yeah.
But then, by 1964, they're happy to use the African population in order to, crush whitey.
Yeah, they break up the ethnic neighborhoods, and this is all under the guise of progressivism, and integration, and racial harmony. Actually, it's the exact opposite, they're creating conflict, and it was so malevolent that in the 1970s it revealed. that the U.S. government, this is the Office of Economic Opportunity, that was then being run by Sergeant Shriver, a Catholic, but they had funneled close to $1 million into this group called the Blackstone Rangers, which is a black gang, to order to force, I think it was ethnic Poles out of a neighborhood in Chicago. Mm. But it was done, again, that's how these programs of uplift, as Martin Luther King called them, were really being used. And you also have the, you know, the spectacle of the community black grants and all the scandals that they revealed in the 70s, how this was being used to facilitate drug trade. But this wasn't just something that just you know, government spending went amok and no accountability. I think there was actually the people who were ultimately implementing these programs, I think, knew that this would be the result. And you know, this is how you usher in suburbia and these things, and you get sort of deracinated white majority today, which is, you know, has no ethnic roots, there's no community, so they can easily be guilted and pushed around the way they are today. You know, the white majority, which doesn't even get a mention in Donald Trump's State of the Union address, but he talks about Asians and blacks and I guess women as opposed to men, I don't know, but no one talks, you know, but there's, you know, that rhetoric, that's still the political rhetoric, you know, today is you're helping the outcast, the minority, and I think that is a strategy, you know, of destroying the European majority civilization in the United States. So I mean, as far as you say, there's some, what's, so you say the Nation of Islam is the best material on that?
Oh, 100%, yes.
Okay, because yeah, again, I read it. There's a chapter devoted to it in E. Michael Jones's the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, and also I think it was covered in this magazine Culture Wars.
It's an exhaustive read. I mean, it's not. It's very meticulous. I can't say it's very fun reading, especially the gruesome. You know, you go probably 100 pages of just the gruesome details of her murder. Mm-hmm. So it's the best book on it easily. I think whoever wrote that, and it's not clear who wrote it because, you know, it's the authorship is attributed to like the Nation of Islam Research Group or something like this. It doesn't have a single identifiable author, but they're clearly the experts on it.
Okay, that's good. Well, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tim. Anytime, I'm always happy to come on.
And, Chris, follow your work at the American Sun and also your participation in the myth of the 20th century.
Yeah, have a good evening, man.
You too. Good talking to you. And, you know, take care, and I'll be in touch.
Yeah, cheers, man.
Go on. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.